Today's program is brought to you by Austin East Ciders. For more information, visit their website at austineastciders.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Main Course without Patrick Martins. I am Alexis McLaughlin, here as always with the wonderful Philip Gilmore.
You're chipper this morning.
I'm trying to be. I'm
well,
like...
Well rested?
No.
Insane?
No one could argue that I'm well rested today. I had a late night last night.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Where'd you go?
Just the East Village.
Round town?
Yeah. All the places.
Yeah.
Tile bar. Ooh. Nothing good starts there. Yeah. But you know, I'm feeling good, ready to attack the day.
Yeah.
Very excited. We have director Shan Nicholson, who directed the movie Rebel Kings.
Yes, yes.
So this is pretty cool.
Do you also go by MC Shan?
No, that's it's not funny. You. It's, I grew up in the same neighborhood, but I no MC Shan. It's funny that you guys consider this morning.
Oh yeah.
It's a Sunday.
That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, if it wasn't for the show.
Right. I'd be in bed, too.
Yeah. I'd be scanning Grubhub right now.
It's a good place to start.
Yeah.
I went to Brooklyn Natch for a wrap before I came here. I was telling them. Some guy came in and ordered a chicken parm with mayo and cucumbers.
That sounds good.
Thoughts? That's what I said.
Maybe raw onion.
Oh, Tito Cabrera. What's up?
What's up?
I guess they can't see that you're in the room.
Yeah. He's kind of... I guess he's kind of like the unofficial executive producer of the show now, right? Yeah.
It's kind of how it's turning out. I like this.
We'll put it on your resume. We'll throw it in. Yeah.
Let's make sure you spell my name right.
Yeah.
I'll do it. I'm a terrible speller.
How do you say his last name?
Cabrera.
Cabrera.
I'm learning from you. I learned it from you.
So Shan, what's up, man?
How you doing?
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Good day.
Yeah, you guys. I was up late last night myself. So
where'd you go?
I was DJing. I don't want to. Yeah. Nothing special to talk about. But forgive my voice. I don't normally sound like Barry White. But
you're trying something special for us today.
I'm also fighting this cold. It's been going around.
So where do you live right now?
I'm in Long Island City.
Yeah.
Cool. I lived in Long Island City my whole entire life.
I grew up
in Long Island City.
Nice.
One of the last of the Mohicans, as they speak, they say. My neighborhood was interesting because, unlike Bushwick, where, you know, Bushwick went through this period of, like, where artists would move in and, you know, like, where we are now, it's pretty cool. And then it becomes super gentrified and, like, all the money comes in. Like, Long Island City kind of skipped that process. It went, like, from, like, shit to, like, million-dollar condos everywhere. There wasn't any sort of, like, cool period in between. It was just sort of, like...
Yeah, it was just kind of like... What year did PS1... I mean, PS1 has always been doing this, but when was the big redo? Like, 2000, 2001?
Yeah, that's when they started doing
the summer parties,
the PS1 warm-ups. Yeah,
yeah, I remember that. I went to the first one, and it was so special. Yeah.
PS1 was. I mean, it's been around ever since when I moved to the neighborhood in 1979.
Yeah, I mean, Basquiat had shows there at PS1.
The No Wave, actually speaking about it, No Wave exhibition with Basquiat and Keith Haring. That was one of their first shows.
Yeah,
was at PS1. I used to run around there. When
probably like what, like mid-80s?
That was 82.
82.
Yeah, that was 82. And I remember as a kid we used to run around because it wasn't just a museum, it was artist studio. So we would like break in there and steal people's spray paint and just run around and cause havoc because it was actually a school.
Yeah.
So half of it was actually like still a condemned school, and then the other half were sort of like classrooms converted into studios and gallery spaces. But it wasn't as big as it was now. It was like maybe a quarter of the space that was used for gallery spaces. The other one, it was just kind of condemned.
I don't think they're doing this much anymore, but I remember the first couple summers they were doing the big shows there in like 2000, 2001. I loved it because people were doing like insulation in the bathrooms and, you know, like everything, or like the janitor's closet. I don't think the last couple few times I've been there, they haven't been doing that. But
those parties were the shit. Yeah. Man. I remember there was that one party that they had a whole entire wall of fans that were like blowing back and like outdoor fans that were just blowing onto the dance floor. It was awesome. Yeah. Shouts to PS1. They're doing it right.
Yeah, man.
Still doing it.
MoMA.
Yeah, PS1, not actually a school. I guess people probably caught on to that.
Where were you? Where were you actually born?
I was born, believe it or not, in Vermont.
Really?
My parents were crazy artist, hippie types, so I didn't spend much time in Vermont. We ended up in Hawaii, of all places, for the first couple of years of my life. And then from Hawaii, we moved to Queens when I was about 5 years old. So I'm essentially a New Yorker. I grew up in Queens from five on.
70s, though, that doesn't get more hippie than that. Yeah. Vermont to Hawaii.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. I mean, they were like, they're OG New York, too. They had a loft on Prince Street. In Mercer, like it was, you know, this was 1972, 71.
Smoking reefers with Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, dude, they had a loft. Check it out. They had a loft. So the first floor was like a printing press for the Weathermen. Then the second floor was like my parents' loft. And then the third floor was Ornette Coleman's loft where he was recording all of those loft jazz sessions. We had a screening of Rebel Kings at the Schomburg Center in Harlem. And this dude came up to me afterwards. He's like, is your father named Peter Nicholson? And I was like, yeah. I was like, how'd you know? And so he comes up to me and he has this Ornette Coleman record called Friends and Neighbors. And he opens it up and there's my dad and my mom.
On the cover of the album?
And my older brother, like on my mom's knee, like, and Ornette Coleman is like 2 feet away from them playing.
No way.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Friends and Neighbors.
Yeah, Friends and Neighbors.
Your mom was also cool with Keith Cameron, right?
Yeah, my mom was a portrait holographer. And she used holography to make portraits, basically.
What's holography?
Holograms.
Like the old 70 ones?
Yeah,
like
exactly.
The Jesus Christ.
Or like the ones that, but these were different. You shine a light on them and the image actually comes out. It's almost like, honestly, it's a little spooky. Yeah. It's like, there's a special type of light and a special type of laser to make these things. And but it's beautiful. They're amazing as well. Yeah, she's done that for years, and she did Keith Haring, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jackie Joyner Kersee, like tons and tons of celebrities.
Wow.
Yeah, she's retired now, but that's part of the reason we moved to Long Island City was there was a lot of space available for very cheap, so they started a company over there. Excuse my voice.
Oh, that's
like,
okay.
I'm like suffering over here.
So you come from a pretty like artistic background. When did you get into filmmaking? Did you set out to be a filmmaker?
No, actually, it was filmmaking came on the heels of music. Actually, I spent many many years DJing. I still DJ, and also producing music. I was into hip hop production for, 10, 15 years, mostly underground stuff. And I got into filmmaking almost in the same way that making music, because I was an avid digger. Like I dug, you know, for records, you know, all of my adult life basically. And you know, my first film, Downtown Calling, was kind of an extension of that because it was about music in the 70s in New York City. And I can't really talk about it, but essentially it was kind of like an extension from making music and digging for records. Both my first two films were essentially about music as a backdrop. So that was kind of how I got my start.
So you saw the documentary, right?
Yeah.
So the Ghetto Brothers?
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Yeah.
That story about you going digging through the crates and you found...
Right. So, I mean, the Ghetto Brothers are the center of Rebel Kings. That's the center of that film. And, you know, their record is one of these, like, Willy Wonka in the chocolate... You know, like the golden ticket. You know, if you're a digger and you find an original pressing of the Ghetto Brothers, they only had one album. And it's super rare. It's like, you know, sometimes I've seen it on eBay for like, you know, $1,000 and I forgot where I saw it. I don't know if it was A1 or Sound Library or one of these old record stop in the East Village. But I was always curious about like why that record was so expensive. And their backstory is really what was so incredible. I mean, it's a great record, and it's a really, you know, amazing story behind the record, but I think that's what really, you know, the Ghetto Brothers story was actually what drove that record to that price, right? And I just fell in love with their story. I mean, the peace treaty and the Benji and Karate Charlie, rest in peace. You know, I really fell in love with the characters, and I decided to. It was like one of those stories that was actually kind of like haunting me because I had just finished my first film. It didn't get distribution, so I was kind of bummed, and I was really like, I don't know if I want to start another film. But it was like, I don't. It was like serendipitous. Like there was like, you know, I would run into somebody and it was like, oh, did you hear about that Ghetto Brothers article that just came out, or this book, or this, you know, this website that had the record? And I was like, wait a second, why does everybody talk about the Ghetto Brothers? Like, nobody knows about the Ghetto Brothers. Now all of a sudden people are talking about the Ghetto Brothers.
And what year was this when you kind of had the first inspiration?
This was about 8 years ago.
About 8 years ago.
Eight years ago. Yeah. So...
And growing up in the culture, you know, artistic, and, you know, your parents, and also New York City and Long Island, graffiti and all that stuff, so you kind of knew the core backstories, kind of, you know, being in hip hop and, sure, you know, being a New Yorker.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the outlaw gangs had kind of passed in my neighborhood at that point. I mean, but we definitely, you know, there was always like the OG dudes like doing chin-ups on the monkey bars, and they were always like, they're still outlawed out, you know what I mean? And like, so the outlaw gangs were still kind of like an echo of the past. This was my, you know, when I was growing up, it was more like Zulu Nation and Shorty Busters and 40 Busters and Boom Bap and all these Queens crews, DTC, TA7, all those guys. But it was crews. It wasn't like outlaw gangs, you know? But we heard like the echoes of those gangs, and, yeah, so it was always kind of like...
They were kind of basically, you know, kind of like maybe like glorified social clubs that also probably did a little selling of drugs on the side, but they were more like family kind of...
Yeah, I mean...
Not as organized and devious maybe as the old days.
Well, no, some of these crews were definitely... I mean, you got to remember this is also like when drugs kind of took over, so...
Are we talking about like in the 70s or later?
I'm talking about my era, was like the 80s, essentially. Yeah. So, the outlaw gangs were still around, but they weren't as prominent as they were in the
70s.
Oh, and
they were also pre-crack.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so when crack came around, that changed the landscape quite a bit. And so it wasn't about pride in your neighborhood and like, you know, this is my turf and that's your turf. Now it was about like, you know, get off my corner because I'm making thousands of dollars a day here and I'm going to shoot you.
I've actually thought about that. There's like this kind of like almost like West Side Story, you know, like, you know, the gangs are like evil, not evil, but, you know, they're outlaws and they're gangsters. But there was like some sort of like kind of like, I don't know, like honor amongst thieves, even though they were killing each other. Yeah, but crack coming into like made everything dirty.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, the thing about it is that it should be said that these guys were the law of the land. I mean, they were there to protect their neighborhood. You know, let's not get it twisted. They didn't, you know, a lot of the, you know.
But then crack comes and then they're selling it to their cousins.
Yeah, that's true. But that's a different generation. Yeah, that's not the same generation.
Exactly.
It's the generation that's like, yeah, I'm sure like a lot of the outlaws. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of those older guys are the guys that started using crack, you know, because they were doing, you know, coke, and it was glamorous. And then when crack came around, they were sort of like the first generation of dudes that. And I remember seeing dudes that I was just like, man, this guy's the coolest dude. Like when B-Boys came up, you know, that was, remember this dude, Shorty, I mean, he was the king of the neighborhood. He was had this huge boombox, and we were like mice, you know, like following after this dude in the early 80s. And then when crack hit the neighborhood, he became like the first crackhead on the block. And it was just like, oh, there goes Shorty.
Yeah.
It was crazy because it was half my neighborhood was started to sell crack and the other half started to use crack. So like best friends that grew up together were on either one side of that equation, and it was just ugly. And fortunately for me, I was the generation that saw, like, I was like the Just Say No generation. So I saw, like, so hard drugs, like, that's what that equaled to me. I was like, oh, you're either going to be a crackhead or a crack dealer. You know, so I never tried coke. I never tried heroin. I never tried any hard drugs because I was like, this shit is too crazy.
You know,
it's like, there's no... You know, it's not a party thing for me. This is...
Well, like you said, you saw the progression. I think, like, you know, white kids in the suburb, they don't actually get... They think drugs are cool, but they don't get to see somebody that they knew go from A to B to, like, okay, you know.
And people's bombs and yeah, it was a plague. It was just like what people say, man. It was a plague. Like, I saw, you know, people that I genuinely respected and loved and, you know... Friends of mine's mom that you know come over and have dinner and just it became really ugly. And Long Island City was small because we were like right in between Queensbridge Projects and Greenpoint, so it was a small community. But it was hit with it. You know,
that's what you gotta love about New York City. Like even with all that chaos, there was still like a sense of community.
Yeah. There was still, you know.
There are crackheads.
No, for me, like, I mean, Shannon's a bit older than me, but I was.
You can say it. I don't.
No. I was growing up. I was an '80s kid, right? So, like, my grandmother.
What year were you born? You were born in
'84. So, maybe by '88, '89, I was already going out to play when I used to go see my grandmother in the Bronx on like right around Taft, like 175th, and I was. My parents were strict, but for some weird reason, they would let me play stickball in like the vacant lots and everything. And then, like when I look at your photos, it always takes me back. I feel a little bit nostalgic through that. Yeah. But I asked my folks, I was like, "Dude, as strict as you guys were, why did you guys always like?" I found it weird looking back. You guys would let me play like in the hydrants, playing skelly or playing stickball.
Yeah.
And they said, back then, if you weren't in the gang, they weren't going to mess with you, so the kids were safe, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it was just like that, one of those unwritten codes.
There was sort of like you're right, there was like a code in the neighborhood, and like, you know, somebody would lean out the window, that even though if it wasn't your mom, it was somebody, you know, I'll tell your mother,
yeah.
Whatever, you know? I mean, Long Island City was kind of unique in a way where, you know, it was an industrial neighborhood, so... And industry had kind of pretty much moved out, so there was a lot of abandoned buildings, a lot of, you know, burnt down buildings. I mean, I tell stories to my wife, she doesn't believe. People would know, you know, like if you had a stolen car and you wanted to get rid of it, you just drive it up to my neighborhood and strip it and leave it there, or like set it on fire. So in the morning, there'd be like a car, you know, on cinder blocks, or like somebody would roll up with a van, you know, with shit in it, basically, and just open up the van and throw out the couch, and it was just like there'd be a couch on the sidewalk. So it was just like one of these weird sort of abandoned neighborhoods, but it was so much fun for kids, you know.
Right.
It was like so it was like an adventure. Like, I mean, there was this one coffee factory that was abandoned that we used to love. Like for some reason, it was this one building. We scale up this. Drainage pipe to get onto the roof, and we'd spend all day on the roof. And it was like right between 44 Drive and the next block over. And the next block over was basically a hostro. There was like nothing but prostitutes there. So we'd climb up on this roof and just like look at the prostitutes all day.
You know, around here, this would be a whole bunch of prostitutes.
Yeah,
like, this is like the main.
I remember.
Summer. Yeah,
I remember. I remember Bushwick well back in the 90s.
Yeah, I moved in Bushwick in 99 or 2000, somewhere like that, but yeah.
It was still hairy back then.
Yeah.
Back when there used to be a lot of car fires here, too.
Yeah. I told that story before.
Yeah.
I actually, so, you know, I got here and there was cars on fire all the time. And I finally got, you know, got good with the neighborhood and, you know, so became friends with everyone. And I finally asked them, like, what's up with all the, so, okay, obviously there's cars that are stolen. They just torch them. But yeah. You know what the other part, you know what the other thing is? Right. The cars on fire? Lease cars. So your lease is up in a few weeks. if you have a lease car, it's 100%. Everything's covered, but you know, you got like a wreck, maybe there's some cigarette holes, right. Maybe there's some dog shit, you know, like something, yeah. There's some stain, your kid dumped a fucking Coke on the seat, yeah. They're going to charge you $300 for that, there's a bump, that's going to be in jail. So you just torch the car,
wow. And then
in the morning you say, oh yeah, my car's stolen, you pretend like you go down to the pound and see if it's there, of course it's not, and then it's 100% covered, so you don't have to pay for the lease.
So it's like burning the buildings.
Yeah.
Yeah. My mind was thinking something totally, yeah. It's like dead bodies in the building. I was like, is that what it's about?
Oh, that's two for one. Yeah.
So what else did you guys grow up doing if you weren't doing crack and you weren't selling crack? I mean, besides watching prostitutes.
No, he said he didn't. He, just for the record, we can rewind. He said he didn't ever smoke it. He didn't say no.
I've never done any hard drugs.
No, but he never said that he didn't sell it. Let's say he didn't say that yet.
I never sold drugs.
Okay. Now he said it.
He played basketball.
I never sold drugs. No. I grew up as a... I mean, hip-hop basically kind of informed my life from day one. If it wasn't breakdancing, which you know I started doing, I moved from breakdancing into graffiti. I was a graffiti artist for many, many years. Then from graffiti, I moved into beat-making. Never was an MC, but I pretty much did everything else. So that's kind of like, I, graffiti was in my childhood. I started writing graffiti, I guess, when I was like 13, 14 years old, around 88. I stopped around 96, 7, around there.
That was the height of graffiti in New York as well? Or?
Well, it was kind of like when I was the generation where graffiti moved off the trains and onto everything else. Like, it was for us, it was more like train line. So if you know, I grew up on the 7 line, so it was all, like every station was bombed, every you know powerhouse between stations was bombed, rooftops and everything. That was kind of like our target area. But it was street bombing. It was like everywhere was bombed. Everything in New York was bombed at that time. But my generation missed the trains by about 2 years. but I certainly grew up watching train graffiti. You know, I grew up close to Queens Plaza and 45th Road, so those are all outdoor elevated trains. So I remember seeing whole cars driving, you know, from the 7 trains and the N trains.
You ever run into Doe's Green? You know Doe's Green?
I know. I've never met him personally. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of his work.
And yeah, I became friends with him when I moved to New York. I was, you know, bartending in Williamsburg and mutual friends. He's awesome. I think he lives in Hawaii now. I think he has some sort of like organic, like, I don't know, hexadrone house or
that
something.
That doesn't surprise me. Yeah, yeah. No, he's
awesome. He's a good guy.
He seems like a very cool brother. I'm definitely...
He was like Rocksteady Crew, I think.
Yeah, he's Rocksteady Crew, yeah. And graffiti legend. And an amazing artist as well.
Yeah. Yeah, shout out to Doe's Green. Yeah, who else did I meet when I first got here? Future 2000.
Yep.
He used to, his son Tim used to work at Diner when I first started working there. So
I worked with Tim at Bob Bar back in the day.
Who his son?
Yeah.
No shit. Yeah, Tim. And then Tabitha. Yeah, she's doing some. I think she's doing like magazine stuff. This guy's like, you know, legendary graffiti artist, but his kids are both like these.
He's in the John Mayer video. You know the one, Waiting for the World to Change.
He's
doing a piece.
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with that video.
Speaking of Long Island City, what about Amanda Cotti's? You know that place?
Yeah, yeah.
That place is awesome.
Yeah, Amanda Cotti's rocks. Yeah, for sure.
It's like old school. Like Tony Bennett still eats here like once a week.
Of course.
You know well, there's two now. There's the Amanda Cotti, and then there's the newer one, Amanda Cotti Rustica or something.
There's one exactly. The there's one that just opened up. There's Bella Villa also. That's pretty good.
So, but the original Amanda Cotti, you know, the mom, she's like 80 years old. She still works 6 days a week in the kitchen.
Wow.
She's still doing it. That's why, like, you know, like old school, like people like Tony Bennett still go there because the mom is still cooking.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Amazing. Are you saying Manicotti?
Mandu Cotti.
Mandu Cotti.
I think, is that right?
Yeah,
Mandu Cotti, yeah.
Okay.
It's awesome. It's like, you know how there's like old school restaurants maybe in you know, Little Italy and Williamsburg that are like
Bumonti's.
Yeah, that's like good, but it's like straight up American Italian.
It's red sauce.
This is like just a little bit north of American Italian. It's like a little bit better, a little bit more Italian than most of the old school places that are just kind of American Italian.
Yeah, I feel like Queens is a good place to find that.
Like they make their own cavatelli every day, you know, the hand rolled. That's the sound of kind of cavatelli.
Let's take a quick break and then we'll be back to talk more.
Yeah, we should probably talk about the movie eventually, too.
We'll get
no,
there.
Just kidding. It's a 3-hour show, right?
Yeah.
All right, bye.
Are you an East Sider? We live on the east side of town. Our shipping container studios are at Roberta's in Bushwick, across the East River, separating New York City and Brooklyn. In all my recent travels, it seems like the east side of town is the cool side of town in cities across the country. East Nashville is full of musicians and weird bars. The up-and-coming neighborhood around 8th Street in D.C., on the east side, is overflowing with exciting food and nightlife. The best hidden spots and funky artists in New Orleans are in the Marinian Bywater, which, yup, is the east side of town. So, as East Siders, we love drinks that represent our values. And nothing is more fitting than a cool, refreshing can of Austin East Siders. That's East Cider with a C. As the name implies, it is cider, and it's handmade on, you guessed it, the east side of Austin, Texas, using bittersweet and bittersharp cider apples. Cider apples are full of tannins, adding astringency and complexity of flavor to every sip. Austin East Siders uses a mixture of European and Pacific Northwest apples to achieve ultimate flavor. Austin East Siders is available in a few different variations, including original flavor, Texas honey, and two new additions, hopped and pineapple. Here at Heritage Radio, we love Austin East Siders with some ribs, pulled pork, and even pizza, especially Roberta's pizza. You can find out more at AustinEastSiders.com and remember to hashtag EastSiders to show your East Side pride. You can also find Austin East Siders on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Hi, welcome back. We are talking with filmmaker and director Shan Nicholson, and don't hop turnstiles, kids.
Yeah. And hide your weed in your hair.
Yeah. don't get caught. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Did you get busted for stuff growing up?
No.
Did you ever get in trouble?
I mean, you know, parents.
Oh,
you
sure.
know. You know, coming home late, sneaking out, maybe stealing a car. My parents' car, you know. I don't think really I got busted too much.
Did you grow up in New York?
I grew up in West Palm Beach.
Okay.
Which, for the record book, actually one time I was my roommate and I were kind of drunk and he's a New Yorker and we were getting in an argument about crack, like the finer points of like, you know, the history. And I'm like, listen, and I won the argument because I'm like, wait, and we had HBO on demand. This is like 10 years ago. And there was a documentary on HBO called Cracktown USA.
Uh-huh.
And it was a documentary about West Palm Beach because, okay, there was like maybe 2 to 3 years in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, where New York was the crack capital of the world. But before and after that, until right now, West Palm Beach is the birthplace and the every year the most arrests, most death, most addiction, all of it. It's like,
I believe it.
Yeah, West Palm Beach
is. I believe it.
It makes sense.
So I actually grew up kind of the same way, like seeing, you know, my mom, I won't mention her by name, but my mom had a friend who came from a wealthy family. Like, she had no worries for the rest of her life and just went from, like, you know, I'm talking about selling, like, millions of dollars worth of jewelry. Taking $100,000, like, yeah, you know, old, you know, Cartier Panther watch with diamonds and, like, selling it for, like, you know,
yeah,
hundreds of dollars of
yeah,
crack.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Maybe if you guys had more graffiti, crack is whack.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Florida's really got a way of picking up the epidemics and holding on.
Yeah.
It's the warm weather, too.
Yeah.
turns crack into an all year round kind of activity.
Yeah, it's a beach lifestyle. Never ending summer. Never ending summer plus crack.
So when you were working on this film, like, how did the story evolve? Like, is this the story that you really set out to tell, or did that change? I mean, through the 8 years.
Yeah, I mean, it. Honestly, I thought, you know, so I discovered the story of the Ghetto Brothers, and that was, at first, I thought it would make a really great script. So I didn't really see it as a documentary first, but I started doing a lot more research, and then I started finding footage on them, and you know, I found footage of the peace treaty, I found footage of them performing. I found a lot of news articles, and I ran across this website. Shouts to my man King Class. He has this website called Classic New York City Street Gangs of the 60s and 70s, and he has been archiving photographs of these gangs for, you know, if I've been at it for 8 years, he's been at it for 20 years. Let's say that. And he actually has a forum where these guys sort of like get together and chat, and they have these kind of reunions and stuff like that.
Just kind of like for the history books, they want their story to be told because they have history.
I mean, you know, also it's like a lot of these guys have become motorcycle clubs because they all idolize, you know, Hell's Angels and all these guys growing up. So now that they're older, they all have motorcycles, and you know, the Dirty One Street Gang is now a motorcycle club, you know, you know, Savage Skulls now have a motorcycle club. The Savage Nomads now have a motorcycle club, where they were kids, you know, as street gangs. Now they've graduated to motorcycle clubs. So now, you know, but now they have this forum with this website that I mentioned. So it was one of those things where it was like turning over one rock and discovering a whole new world, and then turning over another rock and discovering a whole new world, and it just kind of like snowball from there. And I got a hold of King Class, and shout out to Jeff Chang. He did Can't Stop Won't Stop, and it's a great book on hip-hop history, and it really, the whole thing came together when we interviewed Karate Charlie. He was our first interview, and he's the main character of our film. He was the president of the Ghetto Brothers. And his interview, I mean, I think we interviewed him for about 2 hours, and it was just like electric. Like, this dude was, I was just like, keep it rolling. Like, he was just so, you know.
And at this point, you're doing your video interviewing, yeah?
Yeah, we're shooting with video.
How far back was this in the process?
This was the first interview. This was the first interview that we shot. We knew what the story was, but we didn't know how to. I mean, basically, I knew it was about gangs in New York in the 70s, and I knew it was about the birth of hip hop and the connection there. But I didn't. There was a lot of the pieces of the story missing, right? And the Ghetto Brothers were sort of like that linchpin. That was like they were like that one piece of the puzzle that was like the centerpiece. And Karate Charlie was the president of the Ghetto Brothers, so hearing his story and hearing about how they brought about the peace treaty and who was involved and how it all came about, really put the focus on them. And that was like, okay, I understand what the story's about. I understand how to tell this story. So once we had Karate Charlie in a can, we knew we had to get Benji, which was the other main character. He's sort of the main character of the film. And we were lucky enough to get Benji about a month later, and their two stories combined were, I mean, it's epic. They're like, you know, they were like, they have this really great personality trait where there was three leaders. It was Benji, Karate Charlie, and then Cornell Jackson, which was Black Benji. And Karate Charlie was like the samurai sword wielding kind of like warrior, right? And Benji was the vice president. He was sort of like the hippie, kind of like guitar playing, peace loving, you know, the yang to Karate Charlie's yin, right? And together they have this really great chemistry, and this really formidable friendship and leadership. And Cornell Benjamin was their third. There were, like, where other gang had warlords, Cornell was a peacemaker, basically. And so these three, you know, they were the Ghetto Brothers leadership. So, I mean, I don't want to get too much into, like, people have to go out and watch the film, so I don't want to give too much away. But after I got Karate Charlie and Benji in the can, I knew I had a core of a film.
Yeah.
So it was about, like, finding, you know, some of the supporting characters to kind of help fill it out, and finding a lot of the footage. The big thing for me was, I mean, I did it completely on my own, self-funded. There wasn't any budget behind it. I didn't have any real quote-unquote producers really working with me that knew the business. We were kind of just
in, like, the beginning.
In the beginning, yeah. And we were kind of just, you know, figuring it out on our own. Like, I learned how to edit on my own. I learned how to shoot. I learned how to, you know, produce.
I have to ask, like, you know, if I was going through the credits and I saw, you know, Russell Simmons, executive producer, I'd probably be like, oh, that would make sense. And then I don't even know if he was involved or not.
Right.
But then I one name did kind of stand out.
Sure.
Who would that be?
Yeah, it's Jim Carrey.
Yeah, right? Wait. And I of course, saw it, and then I'm like, wait, that's probably just like...
Another Jim Carrey.
Yeah, Jim Carrey, the hip-hop producer from the Bronx.
Right.
Nope, it's Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
So how did that? Is he just like in my mind? I know this is probably not going to be true, but in my mind, he's like, oh well, he's probably like into hip hop, and then he probably collects albums, so he probably has a Ghetto Brothers album, you know, or something like that, and then he gets involved.
Well, but he actually fell in love with the film because of the message of peace. You know, he's
he's turned into some sort of like peace warrior, huh?
Yeah. Totally, and you know. I got to Jim through his producing partner, Michael Aguilar. And that was towards the end of the whole process of the film. Basically, we had finished a cut that we were pretty happy with, and we were looking for finishing funds, so we did a Kickstarter campaign. And the Kickstarter campaign was kind of like, that changed the whole thing for us. You know, we were getting a lot of press at that time. We got an article in IndieWire, which was...
Had you screened it yet?
Yeah, we did a couple festivals with it. We did a couple local screenings.
And but that's not the cut that's out now.
No. So we did this Kickstarter campaign, and it just brought a lot of light to the project. And Dido Montiel, who was another notable producer on there, who did, he's a great filmmaker. He did Guide to Recognizing Your Saints and a bunch of other films. He's another Queens native. Shout outs to Dido Montiel. He actually came on as a producer right before Michael Aguilar and Jim Carrey. But it was through this Kickstarter campaign, and I got a shout out to my man Frankie, who put, the story goes, this is the story of how Michael Aguilar and Jim Carrey got involved, right? So, if you never did a Kickstarter campaign, it's fucking hell. it's like begging for money 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and like literally begging for money. Like everybody that you know, please, come on, man.
Remember that time I bought you a drink?
Exactly, you know. And so I had this crew, man. I'm so, you know, lucky to have grown up around the people and come up with these people and like... Man, you know, I shout out to my New York crew. I love you guys so much, and thank you all for the support. But everybody just kind of rallied around this Kickstarter campaign. So my buddy, he was a bartender at Manetta's in Manetta's Tavern, right? In West Village.
Yeah, cheeseburgers.
Yeah, yeah. So Michael Aguilar happened to be at the bar one night, and Frankie kind of knew him vaguely and knew that he was in the film business, and he was like, hey, listen, I know you're in the film business, I'm not sure exactly what you do, but you gotta check out my man's Kickstarter campaign. And he had an iPad, and this was we would chat up people and have the iPad out.
Wow.
And you know,
no shame in the hustle.
Yo,
man.
I'm saying, man, it's that New York hustle.
Yeah.
And he so he presses play on the, because I had a teaser, and you know, I had all the footage from Rebel Kings, and the dude was like, yo, what is this? What's up with this film?
Did you carry headphones just for this moment? Yeah. You're in a busy park. He was like, okay, please throw here, it put on. Please put these Sennheisers on.
You know, a crowded restaurant. Yeah, you know,
yeah. I want you to get the full experience of the Kickstarter trailer.
After a couple drinks. So I guess the teaser really was effective. So Michael Aguilar that night goes back to his hotel room and you know, there, he goes to the WME, you know, the agency mm-hmm. that he's with. He goes to their website and they have a bulletin board. And he posts that. Does anybody know about this film Rebel Kings? And what's the deal with this film Rebel Kings? And Dido Montiel's agent saw it and said, well, you know, we're talking to Shan now about getting involved to help him finish it. And so, you know, as agents do, they set up this kind of three-way phone call, and we were on the phone, and next thing you know, we're sending DVDs to Jim Carrey for him to check out, and he gave his notes, and he came to the premiere. It was awesome, you know.
I know you're a professional filmmaker, but then, you know, at that level, there's whole other.
Oh, like, yeah.
No. So did they come in and like, okay, so we're going to clean up the title sequence. Okay, there's a little spotty here.
Yeah, like, they love the film, even in its rough stage, and but they did give a lot of helpful notes. I mean, the whole Warriors thing that happens at the beginning of the film, like, that was something that I kind of wanted to steer away from just because I was like,
oh, cliche.
Yeah.
Not too, like, obvious.
But it's also, you know, I talked to the guys. I was like, you know, every gang member that I interviewed for the film, I was like, well, what did you think about the Warriors? And they were like, oh, that's bullshit. Like, bro, you know.
I thought you were going to say, you know, I was in it.
Yeah.
Because they used some real gang members.
Yeah, there were. They definitely. But, you know, at that point, you know, in 79, it was kind of like, you know, they were like the played out. I don't know. Anyway, whatever. I mean, they just didn't like the film. And so I was like, I don't know about it. But, I mean, it really elevated. I definitely, you know, I give props where it's due. Like, those notes really helped. And even Jim Carrey's notes were really amazing because, you know, it goes from, like, really fucked up circumstances to, like, violence. And then it gets, like, hopeful, right, in the film. But in the cut that we had, it wasn't, you know, the violence at the very, Jim was like, you have to make it really fucked up. Like, you have to make it, like, really violent. So when the piece comes, it's way more impactful. And it was something that I was like, oh, well, didn't really see it that way, but, you know, sure, you know? And so, yeah, their notes were very helpful. And just, like, you know, him coming to the opening, you know, that was like, oh, man, that was like a dream come true, you know? Because, you know, he came, and then he wasn't going to speak. And then he came up on stage, and like, you know, it was a huge, like, I mean, you know, for Benji and everybody that was involved with the film, was a huge boost to our morale, obviously. And it was awesome. It was awesome. Shout out to Jim Carrey and Michael Aguilar. And
Jim Carrey, if you're
listening. You know you're listening right now, son.
Well, our friend Judy is on the Get Down.
Yeah, shout out to Judy.
Shoot out to Judy.
I actually know Shan because of Judy.
Like, oh, really? Oh,
no. His wife and Judy are like,
so Tito's girlfriend's on the Get Down, and
shout out to Roxini.
Yeah, man. Roxini. And so is Karate Charlie Shaolin Fantastic? Is that kind of a little connection?
Oh,
or no?
Man, I don't know. I mean,
who knows? I was just an obvious.
Let's
question.
Not talk about the Get Down.
Okay, good.
well, there's the documentary of Rebel Kings, and there's also a soundtrack, right?
Yeah. We you know, because it took 8 years to make, I wanted to really, like, extend the life of the film as much as possible. So, we did a mixtape, which was kind of like, you know, shout out to my man Sammy Needles and Rock One, DJ Talney helped me put that together. Everybody who's listening, go to rebelkings.com and check out the free mixtape. We got a merch line as well. But we put a mixtape together, which was basically sort of a musical, like, if you put on headphones and listen to this mixtape, you're kind of getting a backstory with music of this whole film. So mm-hmm. It would be like what the black gangs were listening to, like what the Latino gangs were listening to, what the white gangs were listening to.
Nice.
My boy Torbert, Little Shalimar, who did all the music for the film, you know, we basically had all this really great music that we created for the film, and everybody kept asking about the music. That was like a huge component to the film. They're like, "What's up with the music? Where'd you get all this music?" And I was like, "Well, we
was made it, was it kind of like rare grooves, like stuff that maybe people had never heard of that was great music?"
Or? Well, the story is that basically, you know, we had all this. Sorry, my throat is conking out on me. when the big problem with the film was clearance, you know, like archive clearance and music clearance. It was the money to clear this film would be in the hundreds of thousands, which was, yeah, you know, out of our budget range. So what we did is I partnered with my boy Little Shalimar, who's like an amazing producer, multi-instrumentalist. He plays drums, he plays keyboard, he plays guitar, and he has just got like the sickest sound. You know, his whole vibe is like, I mean, he's a producer for Run the Jewels. He's worked with tons and tons of people. Shouts to Run the Jewels.
Run the fucking Jewels.
Yeah, man.
They're like probably my favorite album of the last 3 years.
Yeah,
like
man.
The first two albums, my two favorite.
Yeah.
And shout out to fucking Killer Mike, man.
Yeah.
That Bernie support, those speeches. Goosebumps right now, man.
Dude.
What both of them.
Yeah.
LP and Killer Mike, fucking the coolest guys, man.
Yeah, man. Shouts to Killer Mike and LP. They're,
yeah, man.
They're definitely good brothers and
fucking power couple.
Totally. Yeah, they've been also amazingly supportive of the film.
Oh, that's awesome, man.
Yeah,
because they're decent human beings.
Yeah, and Mike, you know, Mike actually, like, he gave us a shout on Bill Maher for the film, and he also like came to our
who did Killer Mike?
Killer Mike,
oh,
yeah,
that's awesome.
And that was like a weird, you know, he saw an early cut of the film before it was out, I think, even. I'm not sure how he got linked up with the film, but he was a real big supporter of the film in the early days, and he actually came to our we had an opening screening in the Bronx. Apropos, you know, Cool Herc came out, Benji came out,
nice.
a bunch of DJs came out, and Killer Mike came out, and you know, I'm pretty soft spoken. Like, I'm in front of crowds, I'm not like the best, you know, I'm pretty mellow. Sasha Jenkins was the moderator for the Q&A that night. And Killer Mike came out and he gave this fucking fiery speech. Dude, like, everybody, he set the place on fucking fire, man. Like, he was just like, "I want everybody to stand up and give Yellow Benji a round of applause and give Cool Herc a round of applause. It's because of them that I have a job." And that, and you know, dude, I was like, yes, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing.
But then did you have to go on after that?
No.
No, okay.
Fortunately, I went on. I know, there's okay. No way that you can't get on the mic after Killer Mike. He's,
you know, like, your comedians, like, you know, comedians talk about how, like, you know, somebody that's, you know, less famous than them going and then just murder it.
Yeah,
and then
yeah,
they come up,
yeah,
and they're, yeah, like, yeah, I was walking into the grocery store.
Yeah, no.
We actually have to wrap up. I want to get you on here again because I feel like we haven't even delved into your fucking brain.
Cool. Yeah. This is fun, man.
Yeah.
This is fun.
Give us a quick any Instagram websites, anything like that?
Yeah, sure. So my handle is @ Rubble Kings, just how it sounds, yeah. RUBBLE Kings. Rubble Kings.
Not Rumble Kings.
Like Kings. Barney Rubble, yeah. Like from Flintstones.
You can go to our website, rubblekings.com. That has all of our handles and has, you know, you could get the film there, you can get the soundtrack there, you can get.
Is everything. It on Netflix?
It's on Netflix.
Do not watch it on Netflix. Buy it from the website, please.
Yeah, buy it from the website.
So it's not on Netflix.
And the soundtrack is out.
Yeah, the soundtrack, yeah.
Check out
iTunes.
The soundtrack.
iTunes.
Definitely check out the soundtrack. Check out Phoenix. There's a bunch of videos out there. Shouts to my girl Roxini and Tunde for their contribution. Phoenix, shout to Run the Jewels for the first single, Rubble Kings theme. Yeah, man, it's dope. Check it out.
Cheers, awesome. Guys. Happy
Thank
Sunday.
Thank you, guys. Yeah. Peace.
Happy Sunday.
Listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Cures my pain.